From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch.
Well, it's good to be here on The Mountain Life. Reports of near-death experiences have fascinated people for centuries, but have been written off by skeptics as hallucinations, religious visions, or the result of mental illness. Our guest, Dr. Bruce Grayson, is a leading medical expert on near-death experiences. He joins us to discuss his new book, After, A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond, by Dr. Bruce Grayson, MD. He says we will finally have answers from scientific evidence about the mysteries of death, life, and the continuity of consciousness. Dr. Grayson, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Lynn. I'm delighted to be joining you here on The Mountain Life.
It's great to have you, and we spend so much of our time on this show focused on the life of mountain life.
Right.
And it's good to take a little hiatus from that and start talk about the after with you. What drew your fascination into this topic? This is a unique topic. Most people spend it on the precursor. Why are you so fascinated with the after?
Well, that's an interesting question, Peter. I was sort of taken by surprise from it. I grew up, as most people do, as Lynn mentioned, I'm thinking that death was the end, and that wasn't scaring me. That was fine. I grew up in a scientific family where what you see is what you get. We had the physical world, and we didn't think there was anything else. It never came up in our family. So I went through college and medical schools with that materialistic mindset that the only thing that's real is what you can smell and taste and hear and measure, and that's all there is. And when you die, that's the end of it. And then in my first weeks as a psychiatric trainee, I was asked to evaluate a patient in the emergency room who had overdosed. I went to see her, and she was unconscious. I could not arouse her. But her roommate was waiting in another room about 50 yards away to tell me about the patient. So I talked to the roommate, got information about what the stressors and that patient's life were like, what she might have taken, said goodbye to her, and then went back to the patient who was still unconscious. So we arranged for her to be admitted to the intensive care unit, and I would see her the next day when she woke up. Well, the next day when I did, I introduced myself, and she opened one eye, she was barely awake, and said, "I remember you from last night. I know who you are." Kind of stunned me because I didn't see how that could possibly be. So she said, and she saw my confusion and went on to say, "I didn't see you in this room. I saw you talking to my roommate down the hall." At this point, I was just blown away. I couldn't imagine how that could be. The only way she could have done that is if she had left her body and joined me in the other room, and that made no sense to me. As far as I could tell, I was my body. So, sensing my confusion, she went on and told me about the entire conversation I had with her roommate, what we were wearing, where we were sitting, the questions I asked, her answers. I had no idea what to do with that. But my job there was to help her with her confusion, not me with mine. So I had to stuff my feelings aside then and talk to her about thinking about suicide and so forth. And then I continued to just sort of stuff it away, thinking after the fact, it must be a trick somehow. It couldn't possibly have happened. I just couldn't imagine that. It wasn't until several years later, in 1975, that Raymond Moody wrote a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us a name for these things, near-death experiences, and described the phenomenon for us. And he happened to be working at the University of Virginia, where I was. And I got to talk with him and read his book. I realized what this patient had told me was not just one incident from a psychiatric patient, but it was something that millions of normal people all over the world were reporting. I still couldn't understand it, but as a scientist and a skeptical one, I thought my responsibility was to look into it and try to study and try to understand it. And if I couldn't, I wasn't being a true skeptic. Hmm. I wasn't really questioning my beliefs. Right. And here I am, 50 years later, still trying to understand.
Well, I certainly can appreciate the fact that you're still trying to understand it, and yet you're one of the experts, or the expert, on these near-death experiences. And what a transformative experience to have that would shock all of your kind of presumptions of understanding. But then to try to delve into this from a scientific perspective, to come up with a research modality that actually makes sense and wasn't, you know, perpetuating some kind of, preconceived ideas. How did you come up with a research method that actually made sense and had validity?
Well, it was obvious to me that single incidents like this patient who had talked to me are not proof of anything. Just, I needed to collect a large number of these cases and analyze them, see if there were consistent patterns that I could do research on. And I did. I collected more than 1,000 cases from my research. I talked to many more thousands who were not included because I didn't have enough information about them. But I found through statistical analysis that there were certain recurrent patterns that occurred in these experiences, a sense of leaving the body, a sense of overwhelming peace and well-being, often entering some apparently other realm or dimension, encountering other entities that weren't physically present, some of which there was a loving being of light that radiated warmth and love, and many people interpret that as a deity. Other entities they thought were deceased loved ones. And these were consistent across cultures, studies in Arabic countries, in Hindu Buddhist countries, and throughout Asia. And they are similar to accounts that have occurred throughout the centuries. We have reports from ancient Greece and Rome about similar experiences. We have accounts from the Native American cultures that were picked up by French fur traders in the 1600s, and accounts from Polynesian indigenous people that are all basically the same, regardless of their religious beliefs or their culture.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, our guest is Dr. Bruce Grayson. He has written a new book called After: A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. And I feel like I just have to say that you are Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the UVA School of Medicine, and have served on the medical school faculty at the University of Michigan, Connecticut, and again, Virginia. And the reason that I have to rattle off all of your credibility and in terms of being a scientist and a doctor is, again, because with these near-death experiences, I mean, you found a way, as you know, Pete was asking, how to research it, but 1,000 experiences, and they're really all anecdotal. Or are they not? Is there some way to measure consciousness or what happens immediately after death?
Well, they are anecdotes, but I would say that all of science starts with anecdotes. Those are simply our observations. And you need to collect enough anecdotes to find patterns to do research on. And that's what we've done. For example, we have looked at the quality of the memories of NDEs compared to memories of real events that happened, and memories of dreams or hallucinations. And the memories of near-death experiences are just like memories of real events, with the vivid and accurate details, unlike memories of dreams or imagined events. Furthermore, we've measured the EEGs, the brain waves of people, as they're remembering the NDEs. And the brain waves are like the processing of real events, not the processing of fantasies. We've also studied the physiological things going on in people as they are approaching death. For example, one of the original thoughts was that a lack of oxygen in the brain was causing these hallucinations. Mm-hmm. But what we find is that people who have near-death experiences actually have more oxygen going to their brains than people who don't report NDEs. Mm. Similarly, with drugs given to patients who are dying, the more drugs you're given, the less likely you are to report a near-death experience. And on, we've tested hypothesis after hypothesis and have not found any physiological event in the body that is associated with near-death experiences, nor any personality traits. Now, that doesn't mean we will never find them. Science is constantly making new technologies and progressing, but at this point, we don't have a medical explanation for how these things come about.
So interesting. So the stereotypical story is, you know, that you see this bright light, and it's very tempting to go into this light, that something is calling you, it feels great, you feel euphoric. Take me from that stereotype into what, you know, the general story is of 1,000 near-death experiences.
Well, of course, it differs from person to person. And one of the most consistent things is when you ask someone what happened in the near-death experience, the first thing they almost always say is, well, I can't put it into words. There's just no words to describe what happened. So So we researchers then get very excited and say, great, tell me about it. So we know that we're forcing them to distort the experience by putting it into words. So they end up using whatever metaphors they have available to them to describe what happened. An example is the warm, loving being of light that makes them feel warm and protected. In the United States and some of the Western cultures, they're likely to call that God or Christ, but in other cultures, in Eastern cultures, they don't use those terms. They just describe the warm, loving being of light. And in fact, many Americans will say that. They will say, I don't have a label for it. I will call it God, so you know what I'm talking about. But this wasn't the God I was taught about in church. It's much bigger than that. You can call it God, Allah, Buddha, Krishna, all there is. It doesn't matter. It's sort of beyond labels. So I take what they say to me as metaphoric descriptions of what happens when they die, not as literal descriptions. And as a result, I can't say that I know what happens after death. I can say that I'm fairly well convinced that something happens, that death is not the end of our consciousness, that something about us continues. And whatever they do continue to is not something to be fearful of. These people report almost universally that what happens after death is a pleasant experience. It's a rewarding, blissful experience. And that has profound effects on all of us.
I guess I have to throw a wrench into this, Doctor. And,
Know,
certainly just want to quiz you on how can we rely on these recollections when it's someone's consciousness isn't there?
That's a great question, Pete. I appreciate you throwing wrenches into it. That's my job as a skeptic to throw wrenches into it and try to poke holes in it, see if I can find a better solution. We, in fact, cannot measure consciousness. What we can measure are the after effects, the way it changes us. And what we see, you know, I make my living as a psychiatrist trying to help people make changes in their lives. I know how difficult and time-consuming it is. And here I've got this experience that in a few seconds can totally transform someone's attitudes, beliefs, values, and behaviors. And I've seen this in experiencer after experiencer. They come back with totally changed beliefs about what they should do with their lives. Let me give some examples. One fellow I knew who was a schoolyard bully, his goal was to enter the Marines and become a career Marine, and in fact, got to be in the Marines. He was a sergeant in Vietnam, shot in the chest, had bullets fragments throughout his lungs. He was aired back to the Philippines to a hospital, and during the surgery, he had a near-death experience, a typical blissful experience. And when he woke up, after he was rehabilitated, he was sent back into Vietnam and found that he couldn't shoot his gun. The idea of killing someone else was just so abhorrent to him that he had to leave the Marines and came back to the States and trained as a medical technician. I've heard this story again and again from police officers who couldn't go back and do their jobs. I've talked about it to cutthroat businessmen who decided that competition and getting ahead at someone else's expense just made no sense to them because they realized in their near-death experience, we're all in this together. We're all part of the same thing, and hurting someone else is like hurting yourself. And almost all near-death experiences come back with a sense that the golden rule is what it's all about loving people, treating with compassion, and it's not, as it is for us, a guideline to be followed. For them, they say it's like a rule of nature, a law of nature, like gravity. That's the way the universe works. And they change their lives around, and I've seen careers change, I've seen marriages break up, and it's often very difficult, and people don't undergo these traumatic after effects unless they've been truly transformed by the experience itself.
That's such a powerful walk away and can resonate with all of us, whether we're, you know, near living or near dead. and that's the amazing thing is that I think that many of us aren't fully conscious when we're living and we have these experiences and we're not necessarily cognizant in the same way as someone who comes back from a near-death experience. Can you connect any of this to those who aren't fully conscious and the takeaway or walkaway for us to pay attention to these near, not so near-death experiences that we're having now?
Sure, Pete. So most near-death experiencers say that in spite of all they learned about what happens after death, they learn more about what happens during this life and how you need to live a life that is more meaningful and more fulfilling. And they say that when you lose your fear of death, as they do, you also lose your fear of living to the fullest. You're not afraid of taking chances because you're not afraid of losing your life. So you're freer to enjoy life more, to take advantage of everything it offers, and to treat other people as compassionately as you can. They become much more altruistic in their behavior, and they find that makes this life so much more fulfilling to them. I think that's a message we can all learn from. No matter what your stage of life is, you will find that treating other people with compassion and love really makes you feel better in the end.
Interesting, Dr. Grayson. You talk about the one experience that you shared with us about someone who was not able to go back into war or ever shoot a gun again. Talk about a cop in the same chapter that is titled, I think it's Transforming Life, Lives Transformed. You talk about a cop who almost bled to death, was shot and almost bled to death, and he comes back and he retrains as a teacher because he can no longer be a policeman. Then you talk about Mickey, who collected money for the mafia in the 1970s. Tell us about Mickey.
Yes, Mickey was working for the mafia. He was born to that family, and he had a heart attack and was pronounced dead, actually recovered, though, and came back totally transformed. And the life he led before with a flashy life, hurting other people, just made no sense to him. And he left the mafia. I didn't know he could do that in my naivete, but he certainly can. He was of no use to the family anymore, so they let him go. And he ended up becoming a social worker, working with delinquent boys and spouse abusers. And I actually had the chance to interview his former girlfriend as well from when he was in the mafia. And she complained bitterly that he no longer cared about what she called things of substance, by which she meant money, cars, flashy life, and she was quite disgusted with that. So I think that's another example of someone who was totally transformed by this brief event that takes a matter of seconds, and they turn their life around as a result.
Yeah.
I've seen addicts and other criminals who totally transformed their lives because of an NDE.
So near-death experiences have this very potent effect on people who have had them, and they often come back, as you say, to transform their own lives. But I can't help but ask the question about when people don't come back from a near-death experience and they indeed die, how has this research helped you talk to the loved ones left behind about how they might cope in a different way and not look at it as, of course, it's going to be loss. It's a huge loss. You miss your loved one.
Sure.
So could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, there are certainly lots of accounts of people who do die, don't come back, but in their dying moments say things that sound very much like near-death experiences. They may believe there are deceased loved ones that are coming to greet them, and they actually see them in their dying moments and so forth. But unfortunately, people who do go on to die no longer let me interview them, so I can't really tell you what they're going through. But many people who have near-death experiences and come back tell me about greeting deceased loved ones that have been dead for a while now, which makes you think that maybe there's something about those people is still in existence. And those can easily be dismissed as wishful thinking, expectation. Mm-hmm. You want to be reunited, so you imagine it. But I have a number of cases of people who, in their near-death experience, encountered loved ones who are dead, but were not known at the time to be dead. So there's no expectation of meeting them. And they found out only later that the person had died shortly before the near-death experience. And it's pretty hard to explain those away as just expectation and wishful thinking. Now, of course, even though near-death experiencers think that death is not something to be afraid of, they still grieve, just like everyone else. When you lose a loved one, you still suffer the loss, and you no longer have the daily interaction with these loved people. Mm-hmm. And there's no getting around that. But they can rest more reassured that their deceased loved one is not suffering, and in fact still exists in some form, and that maybe they may be reunited eventually with them. I don't know about that. They say they do, but who knows?
Mm. Hmm. When you refer to the word exist, what do you, just clarify what you mean by that?
What I mean is simply that death is not the end of our consciousness. I don't know what does happen, because because what they tell me, I think, is in metaphoric words that I can't think literally, but they do seem to consistently say that after death, we continue in some form. And it's a confusion idea. Many of them talk about the metaphor of a wave in the ocean. A wave is a separate entity. It's not, it has its own distinct form and structure, but it's part of the ocean, made of the same stuff, and will eventually merge in and out of the ocean. And it's kind of like that's the metaphor for what happens to our consciousness after death. It does retain some of its individual characteristics, but it's also part of the greater global consciousness, you could say, or the Godhead, whatever they call it.
Great. And that's a powerful illustration using the wave, because we see that so disconnected, but the wave is really a huge part of the whole greater ocean.
Right.
For many of us, we want, when we think of afterlife, we think of that individuality of it, you know, that we can recognize someone or, you know, our family. Do you think that your book will run into conflict with that idea and the perception that, you know, I'll be able to see grandma or my lucky dog?
Well, I don't know if it'll conflict with that, because I think it leaves open the possibility that that might happen. It certainly will conflict with a lot of religious beliefs that don't seem to be supported by the data that we have. For example, although some people who are extremely religious before their NDE remain in that same religion and devoted to the practice, but the vast majority of people after a near-death experience say they are more spiritual but not more religious, that they feel that they'll be at home equally in any house of worship of any denomination. And they talk about their religion as well as others being much too limited in understanding what's really going on. And they tend to be just more globally spiritual. And in fact, things like the Golden Rule, which are part of Christianity, are also part of every religion we have on earth. They all say that the way to live a better life is to love other people and think that we're all in this together. I think that's the kind of message that the near-death experiences bring back.
I just can't help myself. I've been thinking about this possible near-death experience that I had, but I'm just so curious about what you might, if you've had these sorts of stories come forth. One day, when I was in my 20s, I was riding my bicycle along a very narrow road. And suddenly I was riding along and I got this extremely strange, euphoric feeling. And about 3 seconds later, I heard a car approaching from the back and I saw a car approaching from ahead. And this road was, again, very narrow. There were no shoulders and it was kind of like a drop off on either side. And I just got this very distinct feeling that I was going to be hit and I was going to die, and I kind of had a choice. And at that point, I just decided and it was just so strange because it was so euphoric. And at that point, I decided I'm just going to get as far as I can off this road without falling down the embankment. And the two cars passed right next to me, and I was unscathed. And it just has stayed with me my whole life. I thought I was maybe supposed to die right then, and I didn't. What do you make of that?
Lynn, let me ask you, Lynn, how did that change your life?
I felt really lucky to be there. I had been sort of questioning where I was, sort of what I was doing with my life at that point, you know, the angst of the 20s. And I just decided at that point to kind of just trust where I was. But it left me with more questions than anything.
Right. Well, I think that's a fairly common experience, Lynn. It wasn't a full-fledged near-death experience, but it did have some spiritual component to it in terms of it makes you think about things that regard your connection to something bigger than your greater self and whether you might have been somehow saved by something here. There's a great example of a alpine climber. He's actually a geology professor at Zurich Polytechnic Institute in the late 1800s, who fell while climbing in the Alps. And as he was falling, he fell, I believe it was 60 feet, he was repeatedly crashing into the rocks and getting bloodier and bloodier. And he wrote that he had previously watched people fall And it was terrifying to watch them fall and fall to their death and get so bloody and traumatized. Mm-hmm. But he said that when I was falling, it was not scary at all. It was blissful. And he detachedly was watching himself get bloodier and bloodier and feeling fine. And he said, time greatly expanded. The faster I fell, the more it expanded. So I had time to think about how I needed to move so I land in a snowdrift rather than on the rocks, whether I should take my glasses off so they wouldn't get broken. He thought about people who would be left behind who loved him. And all this happened in a matter of seconds while he was falling. And it took him hours to relate it. And I think that's similar to what you were thinking as you saw the car in front of you and behind you. You had time to think clearly about how you needed to move, to maneuver, to get out of their way and remain safe. And we see that a lot in people who have warnings about an approach to death. That time seems to expand so they have time to think about it.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, we're so glad that you could join us, Dr. Grayson. It's a wonderful book, lots of really interesting anecdotes. It will keep you up late at night. The book is After, and we appreciate you joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Life.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.